Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Yoga's Healing Power, Looking Inward for Change, Growth, and Peace, by Ali Hamilton. Narrated by Allison Ryan. Foreword. A number of years ago, while visiting Los Angeles with my husband and young son, I did what I always do when I travel. I spent some time researching local yoga studios. It had been a particularly rough time in my life. We were trying to have a second child and were in Los Angeles for fertility treatments that were enervating and depleting. I felt old, tired, worn out, cranky, fearful, and unsure of what it was that I really wanted. As I checked out yoga studios, it was difficult for me to even imagine pushing myself to show up at a class. A studio not far from our hotel had a late morning class listed, led by a teacher named Ali Hamilton. Something about that class caught my eye. The time was good for me, and I liked the warm, inviting sound of the name Ali Hamilton, so I dragged myself there one Friday morning. The class was offered in a huge, loft-like space and was filled to the rafters, it seemed, with hip, perfectly toned, tanned, tattooed yogis and yoginis. I wanted to flee, but I didn't. I unrolled my mat behind a column and stayed, as a beautiful young woman with a wavy mane of dark hair, shining eyes, and a wide, inviting smile began to lead us through what turned out to be a class that was in equal parts kick-ass and inspiring. At the end, lying in Shavasana, I felt wrung out and reborn, my inner life handed back to me. I returned to Ali's class every day I could manage while we were in town. I unrolled my mat behind the same column. I was completely smitten with her, but I never spoke with her, never introduced myself. I'm not even sure we made eye contact. I tend to be shy and hang back in new situations, and this was no exception. But when I returned home, back to my East Coast life, Ali's teachings stayed with me. I had been practicing yoga for a long time, decades, and had developed a home practice. As I unrolled my mat next to the fireplace in my New England home, I found myself thinking of the beautiful young woman who had unknowingly helped me so much during a time when I needed help. And so, after my practice one afternoon, I walked straight from my mat to my laptop and wrote her a note, which went something like this. "Dear Ali, you don't know me, but I was the blonde woman hiding behind a pillar in your class last week in Santa Monica. Your teaching made a real difference to me, and I want to thank you." I knew as a teacher myself that we aren't always aware when we've reached a student or that we're making a difference, and I wanted Ali to know. I didn't expect to hear back from her, but in short order, I received a note from Ali, one that fills me with wonder at life's synchronicities to this day. She had been a student at Columbia when I was a professor there and was a fan of my books. She told me that she would have been completely intimidated if she had known I was in her class, and there I was, intimidated by her. Oh, human beings. We're all so vulnerable and frightened, so filled with insecurities that keep us separate rather than allowing us to connect, which is, of course, the thing we most long for. That, as the saying goes, was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. I have practiced with Ali, had tea with Ali, broken bread with Ali, gossiped with Ali, cried with Ali, and watched her continue to grow and evolve as a teacher, a mama, a writer, a human being. To hold this book in my hands and witness her wisdom distilled into this elegant, warm, funny, oh-so-real, honest account is a gift that it thrills me to know so many listeners will be able to share. Yoga's healing power isn't just for serious yoga students. It's for everyone who is trying to live an authentic life. In her inimitable way, with the deepest reverence and a well-honed sense of humor, Ali has created a field guide that combines powerful personal stories, yoga philosophy, and hands-on practical tools and practices that are both simple and profound. I haven't read anything quite like this wonderful little book. Sit back, relax, and get ready to have your world rocked in the best possible way, Ali Hamilton style. Namaste, Danny Shapiro, author of Devotion. Introduction. One afternoon, when I was a senior at Columbia University, I walked into a yoga class. My best friend had been urging me for months to give it a try. She'd shown me some poses here and there, and remarked on how easy it would be for me since I'd done 12 years of ballet. I thought that yoga was stretching on the floor, and that it was going to be too easy for me. So, of course, I went to an advanced class, and quickly had my ass handed to me. I had all the flexibility in the world, but very little upper body strength. These people seemed to be hovering in impossible positions, and even more incredibly, they seemed calm and focused, and they were all breathing deeply. The next time I went, I tried a beginner's class, and began to understand that the focus of the entire physical practice was steady, conscious breath. And I noticed that when I left, I felt amazing, connected, centered. 24 years later, I really cannot imagine my life without yoga. It is the foundation of every relationship I have, beginning with the one I have with myself. It turns out yoga is not stretching on the floor. It's a way of life. It's a system that teaches you about yourself. It's an incredible set of tools for healing. I think that if I'd never done yoga and I looked around today, I'd be even more confused, because social media can be great, but it can also skew things. If you look at yogis on Instagram, for example, you'll probably come away with the idea that yoga is like gymnastics. After all, you see all these gorgeous young yogis on hot, sandy beaches, standing on one hand or smiling with their ankles behind their head, or twisted into a pretzel. The thing is, you cannot Instagram your process. What you don't see are the years and years of practice, the countless moments of confrontation, the hours of learning how to fall calmly and without judgment, the days when it was a struggle to get to the mat, the poses that just didn't want to happen, and the patience, perseverance, and dedication that went into the pose you're looking at with its perfect filter. The pose is not the point. The pose is just a tool. Of course, some people become obsessed with a physical practice. Culturally, we are all about the externals. We love to focus on how things look. And sometimes we get really confused and think that's what life is about. If I could just look right on the outside, I'd be happy. If I could just graduate from an Ivy League school, I'd be set. If I could just lose 10 pounds or find the right person, everything would fall into place. If I could just press to handstand in the middle of the room, I'd feel successful. The truth is, these are all huge traps. If happiness lies outside of you, if it exists in external objects, then you're really in some trouble, because it will never be enough. You'll lose 10 pounds and think that maybe 5 more would be even better. You'll meet someone, and maybe hormones and excitement will be like drugs for you for a few months. But when they wear off, there you'll be again. Happiness is an inside job. There isn't a big enough house, a fast enough car, or a low enough number on the scale to make you happy if you aren't at peace with yourself. And that is what yoga is about. It's an invitation to journey inward, to take stock. We're invited to look around with an objective eye and see if there are places where we have healing to do, places of fear, doubt, longing, or self-deception that are blocking our ability to open to joy and gratitude. There's a faction of people who think yoga is all about the poses, and there's another group of people who think that it's a religion, or it's New Agey, or you have to worship Hindu deities and eat granola singing Kumbaya all day. This is also a huge distortion. You will often hear yoga described as an 8-limbed path. Patanjali, who is believed to have written the Yoga Sutras around 400 CE, laid out the moral and ethical foundation for people who wanted to begin the practice of yoga. The physical practice is only 1/8 of the equation. You might wonder what benefit there could be to learning about concepts that were presented back in 400 CE. I can't even wrap my head around when that was, But I can assure you that these concepts are totally meaningful today. In our iPhone carrying, kids screaming in the back seat, mortgages due, not enough hours in the day lifestyle. Everyone is crazy busy. Everyone deals with anxiety, confusion, grief, uncertainty, and rejection, and worries about the meaning of it all at some point or another. We've created so much stress for ourselves. If you want to keep a roof over your head, you have to scramble. If you want health insurance for yourself and your family, you need a job with benefits. If you want to be able to take 2 weeks of vacation time, you'd better be willing to make serious sacrifices during the other 50. Where's the part about fulfillment, meaning, and happiness? It's an insane way to live. If you have kids, you'll also notice that parents compete with one another, as if there's a prize for the parent who's doing it perfectly, or an award for having the most accomplished kid. Haven't we all had it pounded into our heads that this game is about survival of the fittest? Who has time to worry about the inside of things? The problem is, this way of life isn't working for us. We have more anxiety and depression today than ever before, and more diseases related to these issues. And our response is to grab a Xanax, a sleeping aid, an antidepressant. Please do not misunderstand me. There are actual mental illnesses and chemical imbalances that require medication. But there's no doubt that as a culture, we over-medicate. We treat the symptoms and stuff the root cause under the rug, along with our hopes, dreams, and deepest fears. We even medicate our kids. Is it ADD or normal rambunctious energy? Is your kid unable to focus, or is he being asked to sit still and pay attention to something that is of no interest to him? Is he the problem, or does the system need an overhaul? Sometimes our relationships fall apart. We have our expectations and believe in happily ever after, since we've been fed a steady diet of that since kindergarten, but it doesn't seem to work out that way in reality. The moment when we sail off into the sunset on our wedding day is not the end. That's the beginning. But we set off without a clue as to how to sail. Until you are right with yourself on the inside, there is no area in your life that's going to blossom the way it could. Not personally, not professionally. And life should feel good. We're here for only a blink of time. I wrote this book because I want to share the healing tools that have worked for me. You do not have to eat granola all day or chant to a Hindu god. You do not have to adopt a spiritual name, move to a cave, or twist yourself into a pretzel. You do not have to be able to touch your toes. You just have to want life to feel good and be willing to do some work to get there. I've been teaching yoga for over 20 years. In 2009, I opened a studio in Santa Monica, California, called Yogis Anonymous, with my then-husband, who was still my business partner. We had a toddler at the time, our son, and I gave birth to our second baby, our daughter, 6 weeks before we opened the doors. In fact, we began demolition the day I was in labor with her. Was this part of some 5-year plan? No. Who would ever plan for so much birthing all at once? But I think that's the way life is for most people. You can make all the plans you like, but that won't stop the twists and turns from showing up. It's how you respond to them that defines your life. Neither one of us had ever owned a business before, although we both had been entrepreneurial in our own way. My ex is an incredible musician and composer, so like any artist, he was no stranger to hustling, to working hard, to putting his dreams into action. And while teaching yoga might look glamorous from the outside, most teachers are independent contractors, working all over town at studios and gyms and paying for their own health insurance, unless they're lucky enough to procure several classes at a corporate gym. So I was no stranger to hustling either. At the same time, my ex had this idea that we could record classes from our Santa Monica studio and invite people to subscribe to our site so that anyone, anywhere, could join us for class. Basically, we opened two businesses at once. I invited several of my friends, my colleagues, to come and teach at the studio. I'd been in Los Angeles for 8 years at that point, and had built close friendships that I treasure to this day. We began a Facebook fan page for the studio, and my journey into the world of social media began. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I'd read some books, and I understood that you only had about 3 seconds to grab someone's attention. So I'd post pictures of cats photoshopped in lotus pose, or dogs in up dog, or posters with meaningful quotes on them. And of course, I'd post about events at the studio. We'd been open about 18 months when we began streaming classes from our studio in Santa Monica across the globe. Not being a very techie person, I was amazed when I started receiving emails from people taking class with us in Hong Kong, France, Thailand, the United Kingdom, and Burbank. Yes, getting over the hill and going to Santa Monica is quite a trek when you live in Burbank. Pretty soon, these people who were joining us online were also fans of our Facebook page. I was getting kind of tired of posting frogs in frog pose by that point. I was sleep-deprived due to having an infant and a toddler, and a new business, and 18 teachers texting me on most days. I was trying to figure out how to balance it all, and my ex was encouraging me to express myself on the fan page in a more meaningful way. So one day, I wrote an essay about loss. I was an English major and a psychology minor in college, but I hadn't written anything that would be read by anyone else since then. The essay was not a 30-second grab. It was long and pretty raw. I didn't spend a lot of time editing it or thinking about it. I figured I'd post it, and my mom and maybe 7 other people would like it, and that would be that. I felt vulnerable sharing with so many strangers and writing something from the heart. In fact, my heart was racing when I hit post. But I was wrong about the outcome. The essay took off like nothing we'd ever posted before. The comments were honest and thoughtful, and instantly I was in a conversation with a bunch of people I'd never met. I was astounded. We realized that people were hungry for this kind of conversation, so a few days later I did it again, and the same thing happened. I was writing about universal issues, rejection, betrayal, fear, shame, guilt, doubt, and people were only too happy to meet me on that field and get real about how life was feeling to them. A lot of people were struggling in turmoil, feeling stuck or confused or angry or unfulfilled. And so the blog was born. I can't begin to explain the way this took on a life of its own, but I'm incredibly grateful about it. I've exchanged countless emails, private messages, public comments, and virtual hugs with people I may never meet, along with conducting life coaching sessions in person and over Skype. All these experiences have had a profound effect on me as a teacher and as a human being. And the book you're listening to was born from that feeling of gratitude. A Guide to This Book. In each chapter of this book, I'll introduce a topic, such as breaking the pain cycle. Then I might share a story from my own life or from the lives of other people close to me that is a modern, real-world example. When sharing other people's stories, I've done my best to limit the details to those that I feel are essential to getting the point across. From there, we'll delve into the philosophy more deeply. At the end of each chapter, you'll find some journaling questions to help you hone in on where you might be stuck. You'll also find some yoga exercises and a seated meditation to ground you, so you feel connected to your body and your intuition, giving you the tools you need to train the mind to be present, engaged, and curious. If you're feeling stuck, these tools will help you begin to shift. You'll want a journal for the journaling questions and also for your gratitude practice. You might find that you like to carry it with you. Please pick something that feels special to you. The Sanskrit word for intention is sankalpa. In order to overcome negative samskaras, or patterns that aren't serving us, we need to set the intention that we want to make a shift and then use a set of tools to see that intention through. I begin the book with identifying samskaras, Chapter 1, Breaking the Pain Cycle, because I believe so many people are stuck in that unconscious quagmire. In order to create something new and find prolonged peace, you really need all the tools we'll be discussing in this book. All these tools work together. You just have to know how to use them. Every spiritual practice and religion has an ethical and moral foundation, such as don't kill, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, be kind, and so on. This is pretty obvious stuff, right? But I think what's powerful about the yoga practice is that it involves the whole being. It doesn't ask you to memorize rules and then try to live by them. It teaches you to practice these ideas in your own body from the inside out. It doesn't ask you to take an idea on faith. It tells you to go ahead and test it out. Work with your own body, your own mind, your own breath, your own emotions, sensations, memories, and pain, so you can open to joy, love, and gratitude. Like anything, an intention only works if you work it. Maybe you'll copy your intentions and post them on your fridge, or next to your laptop, or on your bathroom mirror. Put them someplace where you'll see them all the time so you'll remember not just your intentions, but also to act in alignment with them as best you can when you head out the door for the day. We'll be talking in detail about how to sync up your ideas and desires for change with your behaviors, choices, and actions. Intentions are powerful, but without action, they're just words, and words won't get you far. We're going to delve into all 8 limbs of the yoga practice and some other important philosophical concepts that are integral to yoga and to any healing process. You may decide to give the physical yoga practice a shot at some point if you haven't already, and I hope you do. It's a wonderful way of developing a relationship with your body and tuning into your intuition. Without our health, life is very challenging, and getting on a mat and syncing up our breath with our movement is a sustainable and incredible way to care for this gift of a body we've all been given. You will find accessible but powerful yoga exercises at the end of each chapter, along with a seated meditation. However, breath work, the physical poses, and seated meditation are only 3 of the 8 limbs of yoga, so there is much more to explore. In addition to discussing the 8 limbs of yoga, which include the yamas, 5 ways we want to relate to the world around us, and niyamas, 5 ways we want to relate with ourselves, we'll also talk about the 5 kleshas, or obstacles, that block our ability to be free and happy. The kleshas are ignorance about ourselves and or the world around us, strong identification with the ego, attachment to pleasure, aversion to pain, and fear of death. We all struggle with this stuff. We'll also dive into the concepts of viveka, which means discernment, and vidya, which means clear seeing, or the ability to recognize what is real and what is not real. You'll find this in Chapter 2, Discernment, What is Real. We won't be progressing through the 8 limbs in order. I've used examples from my own life and my own healing process as a through line for this book, and my life has not unfolded in a linear way or according to any formula. There have been surprises, both wanted and unwanted, heartache and joy, and gifts I never would have thought possible. I've found that different limbs of this practice have emerged based on the work I've been called to explore at different points in my life, and I suspect it will be the same for you. Here is an overview of the 8 limbs of yoga, along with which chapter will incorporate each one as the main theme. The 8 limbs of yoga. First limb, the 5 yamas, commitments, restraints. 1. Nonviolence, ahimsa, non-harming, kindness in word, speech, and action, compassion for yourself and everyone you encounter, kindness toward all living creatures. Found in Chapter 7. First, do no harm. 2. Truthfulness, satya, honest communication, thoughts, and actions, alignment between how we feel, what we think, and what we do. Found in Chapter 11, Speak the Truth. 3. Non-stealing, asteya. We're not going to steal material items, nor will we steal another person's time, energy, or heart. Found in Chapter 8, The Things That Can Be Stolen. 4. Accountability, brahmacharya. We are responsible for our own energy, actions, and choices. If we're in a committed romantic relationship, we're responsible with and for our sexual energy. If we're dating, we're kind and conscious. We don't treat people as toys. Found in Chapter 9, Let's Talk About Sex. 5. Non-possessiveness, aparigraha. We're not going to allow ourselves to become marinated in envy, grasping to have what others have or to be where they are. We're going to break the habit of comparing and contrasting. We're going to trust our process. As Theodore Roosevelt famously said, comparison is the thief of joy. Found in Chapter 10, Trust Your Journey. Second limb, the five niyamas, observances. 1. Purity or cleanliness, saucha. The body is the temple, the container that holds your essential spark. It's the instrument that you use to practice compassion, gratitude, joy, discipline, and awareness. It's your home. As such, you want to keep the temple clean and open, so it's easier to see clearly what's happening within you and around you. This also applies to the outer home. The less clutter there is around you, the less clutter there will be within you. Found in Chapter 5, Keep It Clean. 2. Contentment, santosha. We're going to live in the present and open to each moment as it is. Santosha is not happiness, it's an inner steadiness, an inner peace that is not lost when circumstances fluctuate around us. Discussed in Chapter 14, A Gratitude Practice. 3. Hard work and dedication, tapas, fire or heat, practical, powerful work that requires effort. We're going to apply ourselves to the work of healing and opening, and we're going to maintain that practice. For many people, the physical yoga practice, asana, and a regular breathing practice, pranayama, are two ways to build that inner fire. We commit to finding what we need to build that heat, and we commit to maintaining that effort for our own well-being and for those around us. Discussed in Chapter 12, Know Yourself. 4. Self-study, swadhyaya. We're going to look at ourselves with honesty and compassion. We're going to bring to the surface any old wounds or tendencies that are hampering our ability to open to joy, love, and gratitude. When we don't show up the way we'd like, we're going to look at what happened so we can understand what went wrong and do it better the next time. We're going to be accountable for our actions and the energy we're spreading. Found in Chapter 12, Know Yourself. 5. Devotion to the Divine, Ishvara Pranidhana. Every day, we're going to live with the awareness that we're a part of something larger than ourselves. We're going to be sure that we aren't missing the moments of beauty or the opportunities to connect and rise above. We aren't going to take for granted the beauty of the sun, the sound of rain on the roof, or the various shades of green in the trees. We're going to notice that sparkle in the smiles of our children, of our partners, and of total strangers. We're going to honor that spark within ourselves. Found in Chapter 13, Tune In to the River of Life. Third limb, asana. Patanjali described this limb as seated meditation and some simple postures to keep the body healthy, strong, and supple. In our culture, there's a huge emphasis on the physical practice of yoga. Some people want a sweaty flow class with lots of arm balances and inversions. Some people prefer a yin class with deep stretching. There are people who love kundalini yoga with lots of mantra repetition, words or sounds that are repeated to aid concentration, breath work, and kriyas, cleansing exercises. Some people enjoy restorative yoga, and some love Iyengar yoga or Ashtanga yoga. It's very personal. Maybe for you, sitting in meditation for 10 minutes will be the way. I recommend that you explore all the options until you find the one that resonates with you and then stick to it. You'll want to spend enough time on one path to really explore it and give it a chance. You'll have an opportunity to explore the physical practice of yoga at the end of each chapter, along with breath work and a guided meditation. Fourth limb, pranayama. Prana is described as the energy of the universe. And because it permeates everything, it's known as the breath of life or the life force. With pranayama, or breathing exercises, we try to increase the flow of prana in the body. Sometimes this means elongating the inhale, pausing, elongating the exhale, and pausing again. In vinyasa flow classes, we use
sample complete. Ready to continue?